I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Today on the show, the cost of justice. Providing lawyers to defendants who can't afford one is getting more expensive for Maryland taxpayers. But is spending millions to provide public defenders at thousands of bail hearings the best way to reform the state's pretrial system? Or is there another way to ensure that defendants who can't afford an attorney and who can't make bail don't spend needless time in our city and county jails? We'll hear from attorneys for indigent defendants and from a bail bondsman who supports starting a night court to expedite cases. Midday starts after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks with you every Monday through Friday here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City and the Eastern Shore, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. Today, in the first hour, we take up criminal justice and a costly and complex problem: defendants who can't afford attorneys, can't make bail, and end up spending too much time in jail for minor offenses. The state of Maryland has been under a court order to do something about that. Here's what we learned this week from a report in the Baltimore Sun. Beginning as soon as July, criminal suspects in Maryland will have free access to lawyers at their first court appearance, something they don't get now until a judge reviews their bail decision. The change follows two unprecedented decisions by the Maryland Court of Appeals, the state's highest court. In those decisions, the court ruled that the state's pretrial release system is inherently unfair by favoring those who can afford attorneys and those who cannot. In one of those decisions, the case of DeWolf versus Richmond, the court argued that people who are arrested have a constitutional right to an attorney from the very first time they face jail and bail. While many agree that Maryland's pretrial release system is due for reform, the rulings, which bear a significant cost to the state, have sparked controversy, some turmoil in the state's criminal justice system. During the 2014 session of the General Assembly, legislators failed to come up with a plan to fully follow through on the court's ruling, leaving many unanswered questions regarding how the state will find the money to implement the changes going forward. So today on the show, we're going to be talking about this, focusing on the state's pretrial release system, helping you understand it, understand what the problems are, and the proposed reforms. We're joined by attorneys and reform advocates Michael Schatzow and Mitchell Mervis. They represented the plaintiffs in the Richmond Right to Counsel case that challenged the state system. Michael Schatzow, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Dan.
And Mitchell Mervis, welcome back to Midday. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Dan.
We're also joined by Chris Connolly, WYPR's State House reporter, who kept his eye on and covered the General Assembly's bail reform efforts in the past session. So, Chris, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
But I want to ask Michael and Mitchell right off the bat here. We'll do this anecdotally, sort of law school style, so people understand, people in Maryland understand what the problem is, okay? So I'll give you a hypothetical and you take it from there. It's a Friday afternoon in Baltimore, Friday evening. A 26-year-old man is arrested somewhere in East Baltimore for having, some marijuana in his possession. Let's say that. He's arrested. He's taken to central booking. What happens from there?
Not a whole lot for about 24 hours. Mostly what happens while he's in central booking is he will, along with the approximately other 150 or 200 people arrested that day, will move from cell to cell to cell, being shuffled along with nothing happening in overcrowded conditions while they are waiting to see a commissioner, which typically they would see somewhere in the 21 to 24-hour range. And when he goes in front of a commissioner, this 26-year-old individual, the commissioner will first determine whether there's probable cause. But assuming the commissioner determines that there is probable cause, which means it's more likely than not that he committed an offense, the commissioner will then go to consider the bail, whether to release the person or not release him or what conditions to impose. This person has no idea what the commissioner is considering, what the relevant criteria are. There are 14 or 15 things that the commissioner is supposed to look at. The person has no idea, and the person has no lawyer. And if, as happens all too frequently, the person is detained, because the commissioner might set a bond of $300, thinking, oh, well, anybody can make a $300 bond. In our city, unfortunately, many, many people can't make a $300 bond. And then that person will sit there, sit in that jail until Monday, which is the first time they'll get a lawyer and be able to go in front of a judge who will look at the question of whether the bond imposed by the commissioner was the right bond, whether it should be higher, lower, stay the same. And all too often, statistics show they don't do anything to change the bond in a meaningful way.
Mitchell Mervis, let's talk about the commissioner, the district court commissioner. Some people may wonder, why doesn't the defendant, the person who's arrested, see a judge right away? So why don't you explain, who is a district court commissioner? Who are they? What do they do?
Well, the commissioners are a pretty unique institution here in Maryland. Other states have magistrates, but the magistrates make the decision and don't have judges sit above them to hear the case a second time. Here in Maryland, we have a unique system. Commissioners decide bail. They also decide warrants. They decide they issue protective orders in domestic violence cases that then get extended and get heard by judges a week or two later. But the commissioners do a variety of things. Bail is only one of the things they do. They are not required to be lawyers. Almost none of them are. By law, they do not even need to have a college degree, although most of them do now.
In the scenario that I set up for Michael and where Michael took it, would the commissioner work on a Saturday? I intentionally set this up on a Friday to give you this example of the long weekend. This happens during the week, obviously, as well. But would the commissioner have seen the suspect or the defendant on a Saturday?
Yes. They serve 24 hours a day, okay. 7 days a week.
Okay. And I put that on the weekend to maybe it's not an exaggerated case because a lot of arrests happen on Fridays and Saturdays. But during the week, a person would still, Michael Schatzow, still sit in jail. How long before they saw a commissioner?
I think now they're down to about 21 hours. They have to see the commissioner within 24. That's the rule. There was a lawsuit brought a number of years ago at the jail to enforce the 24-hour rule, which was not being complied with. And the real horror story is, to take your same example, make it the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. If that person is held, they won't see a judge till that Monday.
Okay, so we get to DeWolf versus Richmond. The case goes back a couple years now. The Maryland Court of Appeals said, all defendants are entitled to an attorney from the time, as I put it, the first time they face jail and bail, rather than waiting to see a commissioner and being held until Monday in some cases or several days. So the Court of Appeals says, no, you have to have an attorney there, a public defender for an indigent defendant from the beginning, right?
Correct.
Okay, and that's what the legislature was facing this year, Mike, Chris Connolly, is basically a court order to do something about this.
Right, and so basically, I mean, to have a public defender at the jails ready to represent people, the cost was estimated to be something like $30 million a year for the state to do, about 177,000 hearings that they would have to have a lawyer there for.
Wow.
Which is something that was sort of hanging over the legislature during the whole session. Now, the legislature was extremely divided on this ruling. You had some of the legislators who saw it as a chance to reform the bail system. They said, you know, we can really rethink this. We can really overhaul the system. You had others who said, you know, they made a mistake in the Court of Appeals by doing this. And we're looking at a way to even overturn it by doing a constitutional mm-hmm. amendment.
And there was a second ruling by the court in September, right?
Yes.
What was the upshot of that ruling?
Second ruling was a constitutional ruling. So the first time the court ruled on the basis of a statute, and in 2012, the legislature's reaction was, okay, we'll change the statute. Now in September, the court said, no, this is a matter of Maryland constitutional law. You have a due process right. We're not going to let people be put in jail if they haven't had representation. No incarceration without representation. And now the legislature, of course, couldn't change the Constitution, although some of them thought that might be a good idea.
Right. Okay. I just want to emphasize the double pressure on the legislature to do something this winter.
Right. And so, you know, some of the proposals on the most sort of reform, I guess, agenda side, Senator Brian Frosch, who's running for attorney general now, he put in a proposal to create an executive agency in the executive branch that would essentially use a sophisticated computer model to decide what the commissioners are deciding, you know, do that sort of first step of the bail process. And that would sort of take into account a whole lot of different factors to determine whether or not you're at risk to not show up for trial or to, you know, commit another crime while you're out before your trial starts.
Because that seems to be the key thing, right? Whether you're at risk to flee. Right? Is that it? That's the primary reason why we have a bail system, why we have a bail review?
The primary reason is this person going to show up when the person's supposed to be in court?
Public safety is another one, right?
And the second reason is, will this person be a danger to the community? Okay. Those are the only two things. There are a lot of factors that are criteria for determining it, but those are the only two legitimate things to take into account.
So did the legislature consider Frosch's proposal?
They considered it. The Senate even passed it, and then it died in the House. The argument against it was that this isn't really a proven thing. I mean, there are models like this that are used by other states, but they're used to inform a judge's decision rather than have it be a sort of deciding factor. Ultimately, I think the feeling in the House side, at least, was that they really wanted to take some time to study it, to do a pilot program and sort of see how it works, roll it out more slowly instead of, you know, rushing through and setting it all up and doing this, you know, by this summer when they have to have something in place.
Okay. Now, they did put some money into the system, right?
They did put some money into the system. They put $10 million, earmarked $10 million in the court's budget to essentially pay panel lawyers or get private lawyers or even law students who are being supervised by other attorneys to represent people. So it's not the $30 million to actually hire public defenders, have them there, you know, sort of on call, ready to go. And they seem confident that this will be enough to satisfy the decision.
And what do we think about that act by the legislature, Michael Schatzow?
I don't think it was the best solution to the problem. And they really didn't come up with $10 million. They took $10 million that was already in the judiciary budget and said, in effect, in what I consider to be a fairly juvenile way, they essentially said to the Court of Appeals, you created the problem, you live with the problem. And so they took $10 million that was already in the court's budget. They said, you use this, and then the balance, if $10 million isn't enough, it'll go to each locality will have to pay based on their contribution to the, you know, how many lawyers need in each locality.
So you get to start with $10 million.
You get to start with $10
million.
To hire
additional public defenders?
To hire additional public defenders. In a move which I'm not sure I could describe on the air, the legislature put it to the public defender and took them out of the equation completely, despite the fact that the public defender is the institution with the most experience in determining eligibility for representation, the most experience representing poor people. The legislature made it clear, we are not going to have the public defender do this. We're going to force a new system in here and not let the public defender
do that. What is the new system? To hire private attorneys?
To hire private attorneys. Just as the public defender uses panel attorneys when the public defender has a conflict and can't represent someone. But now that concept is now being squared, cubed, or put on steroids because there are going to be only panel attorneys, not the public defender, involved in this representation at the initial bail hearing.
Before we go to our first break here, I think it's important to drive home the point again about what the problem is. Mitch Mervis, I'll go to you on this. People are spending time in jail who may not have to spend time in jail. You would say needless amounts of time in jail, hours and days. That's because of the system. So explain it to our listeners why that happens.
Well, it happens, Dan, for a number of reasons. Number one, the bail assessments are set at levels that the individual cannot afford, oftentimes because the commissioner doesn't know the financial circumstances of the defendant. The second problem is that the defendant may not be a flight risk, may have strong ties to the community, and so no bail is necessary. Nevertheless, the bail gets assessed. The ABLE Foundation did a study of commissioners and district court judges and how they assess bail and how they conduct their hearings. And it found that in a majority of the cases, the commissioners did not know the circumstances of the individual defendant. So they're picking arbitrary numbers. Hmm. And the arbitrary numbers end up being too high for that defendant to get out.
And our pretrial system connects finances with freedom, basically, right? If you can afford the bail, no matter where it's set, you can make bail, you can be released until it's time for your trial.
Right. What the law says is there is a presumption that you should be released, and the burden is on the state to detain you. So unless you need to be detained, you should be allowed out. Now, it's fine that there can be some condition, some security, some assurance that the defendant will show up. But there should be efforts made, required to be made under the law to work out a mechanism that will get the defendant released so that they can be home with their family, keep their job, begin to prepare a defense, and at the same time provide some assurance that they will show up for trial.
Mitchell Mervis and Michael Schatzow with Venable LLP, they were represented the plaintiffs in the case that we're talking about that forced this issue, forced the legislature, the state, to deal with this issue. And Chris Connolly covers the State House for WYPR and Maryland Politics. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Happy to be here.
So we'll come back and talk some more with Michael and Mitch after this short break on midday. Our phone number, if you have a question or comment about this situation, 410-662-8780, the midday email address. You can address a question or comment to us that way, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here in Studio A with Baltimore attorneys Michael Schatzow and Mitchell Mervis, who represented the plaintiffs in the Richmond. It's DeWolf versus Richmond. That's the case. DeWolf is a reference to Paul DeWolf, who's the public defender of Maryland. And Richmond refers to
Quentin Richmond, who is one of the named plaintiffs representing the class of plaintiffs who we represent.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about the plaintiffs you represented, the kind of problems they had.
Well, these plaintiffs are poor people who were accused of very minor offenses, you know, minor thefts, disorderly conduct, minor drug possession, who went before a magistrate a commissioner in November of 2006, said, I don't have a lawyer. I want a lawyer. I can't afford a lawyer. Their request was ignored, and they all ended up not making bail based on the commissioner's bail until at least 24 hours later. And that's how the case started.
And you say that the district court commissioner, a unique system of it, Maryland has.
Yes.
There may be magistrates, you say, in other states, but the district court commissioner, who's a person who doesn't have a law degree necessarily, right? Mitch, I think you said don't even need to have a college degree, right?
Under the statute, that's correct.
Yeah. So they get to set bail, and you said there's several factors in consideration of bail that they don't look at on a routinely ignore or what?
No, I don't think that it's they routinely ignore. It's just that they don't have any information. They have to consider 14 factors, but the person sitting across from them, this poor indigent defendant, doesn't know about the 14 factors. They don't know what they're supposed to say. They don't know what they're supposed to do to get bail, and the commissioners, they don't educate them about that. The commissioner's making a decision, and they're making a decision, and that's what's so important. That's why you need a lawyer there, a lawyer who knows the law, who knows what the criteria are, who can articulate it, and who can verify information that the defendant presents.
And, Dan, the issue of verification is important. Sometimes the commissioner simply doesn't believe the information that the defendant may be providing. We had a case of a Johns Hopkins University graduate student in economics, public health, I believe, who was arrested for a DUI on a Friday night. He had no record of any kind whatsoever. He told the commissioner his story. The commissioner did not believe him. He was African American, said, I don't believe your Johns Hopkins graduate student. The commissioner assessed a $10,000 bail. For 3 days, that individual sat in the jail, wasn't able to call family. No one knew what was going on with him. Finally, he goes before a judge. On Monday, the state's attorney realizes what was going on, and he gets released on his own recognizance. That's a perfect example of someone who absolutely would have been released had he had counsel available that Friday night.
The $10,000 bail seems, in that instance, arbitrary to you, the level of the bail?
Sure, for a person with no arrest record and simply a DUI.
And what would that person have needed? How much cash would they have needed in order to make $10,000 bail?
$1,000.
One-tenth?
Yes.
Okay, and didn't make it. 410-662-8780 is our number here for Midday. We're going to take some calls for our guests, Mitchell Mervis, who was just speaking, and Michael Schatzow, who represented the plaintiffs in this right to counsel case that we're talking about that has came out a couple of years ago and really made us all think about the idea, to me, visualize going before yourself, being arrested, going before a district court commissioner without an attorney. Most of us, people who can afford an attorney, probably call an attorney, say, hey, can you come down to district court or wherever this takes place? I guess central booking, right?
But in Baltimore City, you can't even get in there if you're a retained counsel.
Really?
In
central booking?
That's right. Now, the Court of Appeals was quite critical of that situation, and so I think that once court-appointed lawyers start going in there, retained lawyers will. But there was no way to get in there. I can't tell you how many times the parent of some college student who got arrested for some minor offense on the weekend would call me and say, could you go down there and get him out? And I said, I can't get in there. And they don't believe it. If you talk to foreigners who get arrested here, they think this is the United States of America and I can't get a lawyer to represent me.
What's the answer to the question? Why can't retained counsel get in there?
They're not set up for it. They don't have a place for you to sit. There's no one for you to call. They wouldn't let you in. They just don't do it. And it's because they've been doing it that way for 40 years. They left alone, they would do it that same way for another 40 years.
I want to ask you and Mitch about a couple of numbers before we go to the phone lines. $30 million, $10 million. We just went over what the $10 million is. That's what the General Assembly allowed or took out of the judiciary's budget for this purpose, for providing counsel for people at initial appearances. $30 million is the estimated cost of actually providing a public defender at all of these hearings. And the number is $177,000. That's the number of initial appearances by defendants who are indigent or just general?
The total number. Okay. Mitch is going to talk to you about the $30 million, but let me just use Mitch's example about what nobody focuses on is that the cost of these attorneys is going to be more than made up for by the fact that fewer people will be incarcerated. Take Mitch's example about the graduate student. The cost to incarcerate that fellow for 3 days, much greater than the cost to bring an attorney in. But Mitch can explain the $30 million to you in compelling detail.
The $30 million comes from an estimate that you would match up one public defender to each commissioner. One-to-one.
Okay.
So
do you think that's necessary?
No, it's completely unnecessary. The problem is the commissioner does a lot of things unrelated to the assessment of bail. So it automatically builds in extra cost into the system. So, for instance, if you have three commissioners in Baltimore City sitting at a particular time, actually it's eight, the commissioner's office will divide up the bail cases evenly among the various commissioners. So they may have only 40%, say, of their work actually being on bail hearings. As a result, the rest of the time that a public defender is assigned to that commissioner is not necessary to be used for the representation. Now, there could be investigation time to do conflict checks, things like that. But the public defender picks up these cases at the next round in the bail review. So they're doing those activities anyway. The reality is that if you reorganize the use of the commissioner time in Baltimore City, the amount of attorney time that you would need would be much, much less. So
What about this? In a moment, we're going to hear a proposal for a night court. Or my idea was just extend the hours of a district court judge. Why not have a district court judge work until midnight? I don't know. I mean, it's done other places, isn't it?
Yes, it's done many other places, and there's no good reason why it shouldn't happen here. And there's no good reason why judges shouldn't work on weekends. It will not diminish in any way the pool of applicants to be judges. If I mean, in Baltimore City, what would you have to work? One weekend day every quarter?
Yeah.
One night every month?
Right.
Maybe.
Right. So someone arrested in that my original scenario, the 26-year-old guy arrested for having a couple of joints on him. He's arrested on a Friday, so maybe Saturday morning he sees a judge, or even Friday night.
Or possibly, even Friday night.
Because you know that's a busy time. All right, we're going to go to the phone lines and hear some comments from our listeners and take some questions. Again, 410-662-8780. We start with Meg. And Meg, thank you for holding. You're on Midday.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. So I actually had a question about the release process and the safety of arrestees when they're released. I had an experience several years ago with a family member who was arrested for a failure to appear based on a speeding ticket that was not paid, an out-of-state speeding ticket that was not paid. So she was arrested first thing in the morning and, you know, wearing her pajamas, basically. And then, you know, several days later, we had the bail paid and we waited and we waited and we waited for her. So in that process, we spent hours and hours sitting outside of the place that they release people from. And what I saw was young women being released onto the street in the middle of the night with no clothing, freezing cold. The phones, they don't have phones there that people can use. People didn't have any money. And they're extraordinarily vulnerable.
We hadn't thought about that aspect of it there. You guys have seen this scene in Baltimore City.
Yes. I mean, it again, there's no, as Mitch is fond of pointing out, there's no lobby for the poor accused of crime. There's just no lobby. And unless you get people like Mitch and I who work in a very successful law firm who's very committed to doing this kind of pro bono work, nothing gets, right. These things don't get addressed, and it's a terrible situation. The caller's exactly right. What she describes is perfectly accurate, and it's deplorable.
Are there some systems in the United States that have done away with bail? And can you do away with bail?
I don't know that they've done away with bail. Some places have tried to do away with money bail. On the theory, as you were talking about before, on the theory that you shouldn't be able to get out just because you can pay a bail. And I think, you know, the statistics do not support the fact that money bail increases the likelihood that somebody is going to appear. And this is why the legislature considered this approach of an objective risk assessment standard, in which had been validated by looking at, I think, 1.5 million cases to see what are the factors that are important, what are the factors that are not important. And in many places, in D.C., I believe, they've done away with money bail at the local system.
Yeah, it's like a computer program, right?
Essentially.
I mean, is there a way to assess defendants by inputting more information and coming up with, some computer algorithm that tells you, yeah, this person is at risk, you know, this person is not at risk?
Yeah, what happened, Dan, was the Arnold Foundation examined over 1 million cases nationally to see what factors would predict recidivism for violent crime and failure to appear, both factors. And they ended up determining with a lot of accuracy, they say, 7 factors that should be considered in determining both flight risk and risks to public safety. They've been testing that analysis in Kentucky, and so far they're finding that the algorithm or the study they had is very accurate in predicting what characteristics of a defendant are going to indicate the need for either continued detention or high bail.
I can see that working for a lot of people in a lot of cases, but what about those that, you know, you just can't make the judgment. You just don't know whether somebody is going to show up for a trial or not. Doesn't bail serve as a hammer to get them back to court so that they appear for their trial?
I don't think the statistics would show that it serves as a hammer, and there are other things that can be done. It might be much more important to have a pretrial services agency that's supervising that person than it is to have a $500 bond on the bail on the person that somebody else is likely to have to pay back, not him, if he doesn't appear. I think there are a lot of other things that can be done to assure the appearance and and that should be done.
Let's take another call. Nancy in Towson, you're on Midday. Welcome.
Thank you. Mitch and Michael, I'd like to commend you for your work on this case. This is Nancy Forster.
Thank you, Nancy.
Former public defender Nancy Forster.
Yes. I do have a question, though, about the legislature. Do you think that their unwillingness to provide money and funding for the public defender's office has anything to do with the fact that some of the legislators are defense attorneys in the private bar and would rather see the business go to the private bar?
I don't think there's any doubt about that, but I would not say it so much that there are defense attorneys in the legislature. I think that there are a group of criminal defense attorneys in Maryland who think that way, and they have a disproportionate influence with certain legislators who have a disproportionate influence over what happens with legislation related to the judiciary. But I think that's exactly right, and that's one of the reasons, in my judgment, why the public defender has been taken out of this, is because there are those who feel that if the public defender is representing everyone who's indigent at the initial appearance, that those people will never move to private counsel. And I think that and the impact of the bail bondsman had a lot to do with the legislature simply punting on this very important issue.
I'll read an email from one of our listeners, and then we'll take another break on Midday and come back and talk some more with Michael Schatzow and Mitchell Mervis about this. And we'll also be joined by a bail bondsman, Mark Adams, who has an interesting idea for reform that we thought was worth talking about. In fact, I just alluded to it a moment ago about the idea of a night court, and I think it's worth talking about for a few minutes. This is an email from Barbara. Says the state of Maryland, and particularly the Baltimore City judicial system, has periodically attempted to address the significant inequities in our pretrial system since the early 1970s. One of the problems is that few people care about indigent defendants. Personnel are poorly trained and supervised, and the outcomes have seldom been clearly identified or measured. I started my criminal justice career in our city system in the early 70s when the pretrial release program was initiated. I spent most of my career in the federal pretrial system, which has much better outcomes in large part because of the generous resources and manageable caseloads. I'm happy to see this discussion renewed. It's long overdue. Midday at WYPR.org is our email address. A short break here on the show. We'll be right back. Here's an email from Brian, who says, I have a friend who is currently at the Baltimore County Detention Center facing assault charges stemming from a very complicated domestic situation. He has not been appointed a public defender yet and has been in for over 3 weeks. He also was advised by other inmates not to go to his bail review, which he foolishly did. They ordered him held without bail at the review. There are factors that would probably cause this ruling, but why did he not have a lawyer? I am concerned that our ignorance of the process will get him more time than he deserves. I was told by the public defender's office that it takes 10 days to be assigned a lawyer. This is Brian writing from Baltimore County and referring to Baltimore County there. Is that possible that someone sits around without a PD being assigned to them?
If he did not attend the bail review, he would have had a lawyer at the bail review hearing.
Because the bail review is conducted by a judge, a district court judge.
Bail review is conducted by a district court judge, and the public defender represents all indigent defendants at the bail review hearing, which is the second bail hearing. If he took the advice of some inmate lawyers and did not show up, then he wouldn't have gotten the public defender, and now he's waiting.
How do people get these advice when they're in the system, huh? If you've never been in the system before, you're getting advice from others who have, maybe, and not always good advice.
That's exactly right. Why you need a lawyer at your initial bail hearing.
Right. I want to quote something here from the Baltimore Sun. Ian Duncan and Justin Fenton's story on this subject in January. They say of the approximately 3,000 people in pretrial detention in Baltimore at any one time, nearly 200 are stuck in jail on bail of less than $5,000. Some defendants can't even post bail of $100.
I think that's exactly right, except I think that the number is probably higher than 200 people and the amount is lower than $5,000. Because, I mean, we've cited studies about that have had those numbers in it in our papers. And it is there are people who can't make a $100 bail. They simply can't.
Michael Schatzow and Mitch Mervis, also in the studio with us from Venable LLP, represented the plaintiffs in the case that forced this issue on Maryland to deal with this, not having counsel, not having a public defender or a lawyer available for indigent defendants at their first appearance when they're facing jail or bail in front of a district court commissioner. So the idea would be to get them in front of a judge as soon as possible so a judge can review their bail, get them counsel, but also get them in front of a judge, right?
That would be good.
Yeah, okay. So I don't know if the Maryland legislature is ready to do away with the district court commissioners because they have other duties they need to fulfill, right, Mitch?
Yep, that's okay. Correct.
But when it comes to this, whether you're going to be in jail or not, this question maybe ought to be settled by a judge. Mark Adams is a bail bondsman here in Baltimore City, and he wrote to me about this a couple of times. I thought it was worth talking about. Mark, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So your idea was a night court or at least extended hours of the district court judges.
Yeah, if you look at the history of the district court, we used to have magistrates in Maryland, and it was chaotic. I mean, for example, there was a barber at Cold Spring in York who used to sign orders in his barbershop.
He was a magistrate?
Yeah, he was Judge O'Connor's barber, so they made him a magistrate. And it got a little chaotic. So when they formed the district court system...
In the 1970s.
Right. Chief Judge Sweeney was the first chief judge, and he took great pride in the fact that judges were going to be professionals, and they weren't going to be signing orders in barbershops after hours. Because of that, they created the commissioners who basically act in the place of the judge when the judge is not available. And the system works fairly well everywhere but Baltimore City. I mean, the commissioners...
Because it's so busy.
Yeah, the commissioners see... They probably see more criminal law than most lawyers. And they try to do a good job. In Baltimore City, there's a 17-hour on average wait to see a commissioner. And I get this number from asking people who I bail out. How long did you wait? That's the average. It goes up to about 21. If they get the perfect storm, they get seen in 12 hours. It takes another 5 to 8 hours for them to be processed for release. And as the caller alluded to earlier, the families are sitting outside on Eager Street waiting for someone to come out, sleeping in their cars. They won't let them come in the building and wait, or at least sometimes they will let them, but mostly they don't. I mean, it's a deplorable situation.
Well, what is the situation for people who have money in that situation? Here we're talking about an indigent...
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter who it is. That applies to everybody, right?
They can have great lawyers from Venable, Batra, and Howard, and they'll make them wait in their cars outside, too.
Is that true?
That's true. Right. That's my point. You couldn't get in there before.
The breakdown, though, comes when bail is set, right? And you, if you can't make bail, even if it's $300, you're stuck in there until you see a judge.
Exactly.
Or until you go to trial.
That's right, because unfortunately, the statistics show that the judges don't really do a very thorough job of reviewing the commissioner's bails.
Okay. So get to your idea, though, Mark, about the idea of if judges actually were to work longer hours, even at night, up till midnight or so, yeah, how would that help?
There has to be a district court judge on call at all times. I call him the duty judge or her the duty judge. If someone needs a warrant signed or tries to get an injunction at midnight, they call the commissioner who summons the judge, who's usually not happy about being awakened, and the lawyer goes to see the judge, and the judge signs it and tells him, don't do this again. That's usually the way it works. Mm-hmm. My thought is, why not just have an initial appearance docket and call it every 2 hours? It's all the bail reviews are mostly done by video. So you don't have to transport people across town into courthouses or what have you. Have the judge at some location in front of the video screen as he or she would be in an ordinary bail review. And whoever's in the bullpen, bring them up in 2 hours. Have the public defender there. And a lot of people don't need it. For example, I pulled some statistics from Monday. There were 45 new cases brought in the Baltimore City District Court, which is a pretty slow day. 22 of them were released on recog. So they were just told, you've spent your 17 hours here, go into the release area, and if we determine that there's not a warrant on you from Wyoming, we'll let you go in 5 hours.
Now, those folks may have been arrested Just on Monday or Sunday, Monday, Saturday?
These are cases that were docketed into the district court Monday.
Okay.
So they probably were arrested Sunday.
Okay.
At their 17-hour point, they would show
your
up.
Your point
in this
is
list.
That almost half of them could have been released earlier.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
And why do you keep them? And the conditions are completely inhumane. There's a room maybe about twice as big as where we are, with a concrete floor, one bench, 12 to 15 people sitting in there overnight trying to sleep on the concrete floor. And if they're lucky, there's a toilet in the room. I've talked to people who, when they were really crowded, they put them in a room without a toilet. They wouldn't take people to the bathroom, and the people were relieving themselves through the bars. I mean, this is something out of you expect from Iraq.
But again, when we're talking about indigent versus not indigent, those who can afford an attorney versus those who aren't, this system, the one you're describing, that Mark's describing, Michael and Mitch, it makes no difference what your status is.
That's correct.
Okay.
Everyone spends a day in jail.
The status matters when we get to the second part of this, right?
Yes.
Where bail is set and who's setting the bail.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So you think, what do you think of this idea? I'm eager to hear from Mitch and Michael about the idea of extended hours of judges with a two-hour call for a docket for initial appearances. What do you think of that?
Great idea. We're all for it.
Oh, okay. Now you got to get the judiciary. Do you like it,
yes,
too,
no,
Mike?
Yes, no, I think my personal view is that the commissioners ought to be out of the bail-setting business and that that's a judicial function. It ought to be done by a judge, not by somebody who may not even be a lawyer.
Back to my question about bail, though. I asked you before, I said, do we do away with bail?
And there's a lot of support for doing away with bail. I think there.
What goes in its place, though? If you don't have bail, if you don't, you're saying the studies don't support the idea that people won't show up unless you have a heavy bail on them and they're facing a financial issue if they don't show up, or their mother or their father.
It seems a little counterintuitive that somebody who is charged with having a joint gets a $200 bond, and because they can't afford it, they're going to sit in jail for 30 days until they get to court. And somebody who's charged with armed robbery and gets a $250,000 bond but has the money gets bailed out. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to a lot of people. And one way to deal with that situation is to have a pretrial services agency that would supervise people, that would work on if they have employment problems, drug problems, family problems, and pay attention to what the issues are and make sure the person gets to court.
Maryland law entitles criminal defendants to release pending trial unless they are a flight risk or a risk to the community. I'm reading your own words, Michael Schatzow and Mitchell Mervis, that was published in The Sun. But Maryland's system fails to protect that right. Instead of trying to eliminate rights through inflated cost estimates that we've discussed on the show today, legislators should decide once and for all to fix the system and provide attorneys to end the needless incarceration of thousands of poor individuals. So we're addressing a couple of things here. Expediting the process, Mark Adams' suggestion is actually have judges involved in this system for longer hours, because especially at the busy dockets like Baltimore City. And the second part of it, make sure people have counsel if they can't afford it, right there at the initial appearance.
Right there.
And even if they can't afford it, you should be able to have your lawyer present when the initial bail is set. Right, Mitch?
That's right. I would just like to add one thing on Mark's proposal. In New York City, where they do have night court, the average time from arrest to the completion of the arraignment is under 24 hours. So New York City, busiest place in the world, lots of cases, high volume dockets. They're able to process the cases, give people their rights, and get them out.
And Mark Adams, you're in the bail bonds business, but you must see people who they shouldn't have any bail at all. They should have just been released on personal recognizance and wouldn't have posed a risk, either a public safety risk or a flight risk.
You see all kinds of anomalies. And the one thing that isn't generally appreciated with the public is 10% is the mandated fee for bails. Most bondsmen offer financing, zero interest financing. Someone who's held on a $10,000 bail, like the Hopkins grad student you were speaking about, for $200 he gets out. A practical problem is that when people are arrested, they don't know how to call home anymore, because young people have all of their phone numbers in their cell phones and they've taken them away from them. It happens. I'll get a
collect. I hadn't thought about that problem.
I get collect calls all the time from jail, and they're saying,
they don't know their mother's phone number.
No,
because the mother has a cell phone too, right?
Right. I mean, I don't even know my wife's phone number unless I have the phone. So
I mean, this really happens.
Yeah, all the time. All the time.
Let's take some calls. George and Anne Arundel had a question. George, thanks for calling Midday.
Thank you. Tell you, I'm wondering why to perhaps expedite the system, we couldn't have and this would be at that initial hearing, that if somebody can't make the bail set by the commissioner, that they would have an option of getting the leg bracelet that would, prevent them being a flight risk.
Hmm. Those anklets that they use for a home detention.
Well, they charge them for that. And a lot of times it costs...
They charge the defendant to wear that?
Right, and it's a third-party vendor or a series of them, and it costs more than a bail bond.
This is a big industry, isn't it? Gary in Baltimore, we'll go to you next. Hi. Gary, you there? How about Carl? We'll go to Carl in Catonsville instead. I'm sorry, I don't know what happened to Gary. But Carl, go right ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. I just had a quick question. I haven't gone through this process, unfortunately. I wondered why it takes mere minutes to get processed in and become an inmate, and it takes so long, even after you've posted bail. Take away the indigent and even after you've posted bail, I've waited, 9, 10, 11 hours, and the money's been paid. And you spoke to it a little earlier about people waiting out front. And why does it take so long to release, but you're so quick to get an intake?
Mark, you have some insight there?
There's no answer to anything. I mean, nothing makes sense at central booking. And people get released, and there's this bank of payphones, and they go over to the phone and try to call home, and the phones haven't worked for 20 years.
Michael Schatzow, what's going to happen this summer when we get to July 1st with this issue?
Well, hopefully we'll find that. I mean, we had our fifth argument in the Court of Appeals on this case on Tuesday. And one of the things the court is deciding is when this is going to be implemented. It could be implemented before July 1st. And that's certainly what we've asked the court to do, at least with regard to Baltimore City. And so we don't know. Until the court decides, we don't know when it will be implemented. Right now, there's a stay that's in effect until June 5. If June 5 comes and goes without the court taking any action, then Judge Nance's injunction would take effect. But we anticipate that the court will make some decision before then about what the starting point will be. And I'm assuming that at least by July 1st, this system will be in place and there will be lawyers to represent people in front of commissioners.
Do you expect the focus to be on Baltimore City first?
Well, I don't know. We asked for that. But if they're going to wait till July 1st, then my guess it will be the entire state on July 1st. And we think that ultimately many more people will be released and taxpayers will save money as a result.
Do you have any insight on where that $10 million came from? You said it came out of the judiciary's budget, but I can't imagine that $10 million, this is a lot of money still. What effect does that have on the Court of Appeals budget, the judicial system's budget? Do you know?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know.
The legislature did not come up with more money. It just took money from here and said, here, use this for this purpose.
That's right. And that will be a problem for the judiciary. They're going to have to rob from some other need that they have in order to pay for this. Now, whether there will be deficiency funding available to them from the governor down the road, I don't know. And where they're going to take it out of their budget, I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eye on this. I appreciate you coming in to explain all this to us, Michael Schatzow. Thank you very much, and thanks for your work on this case. Also, you, Mitch Mervis. Michael Schatzow and Mitchell Mervis, both with Venable LLP, represented the defendants in the case that we've been talking about this that has forced this issue in Maryland. And Mark Adams has been with us, Baltimore Bail Bondsman. We appreciate your insights as well.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you all.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. This is just the first hour of Midday. We've got another hour of the show coming up, and something completely different in the second hour of our show today. We're going to talk about life on the family farm with Arlo Crawford when he gets here after the news at 1 o'clock. In the meantime, we're going to take a break for lunch, brought to us today by The Veranda, located in Hamden on 36th Street, serving home-style Indian food. Specializing in flatbreads and chaat, The Veranda now opens 7 days a week for lunch, 11:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Please enjoy our lunch. Well, That's what I'm saying to our guests. I guess you can't through the radio enjoy lunch, but you go to the veranda. They're great.